Will the meeting please come to order? I have two announcements to make. First, as to next week's luncheon, for Friday, December 23rd, Mr. George Rhodes of the San Francisco News Call Bulletin will speak on the subject of Hong Kong smuggling of antiques and dope to the United States. The following Friday will be a ladies' day at which we will hear the Loring Club and the annual Christmas and New Year's music program. It will likewise be the inauguration of the club's officers, and the tickets for that are on sale here, and I suggest that you procure them because they might be hard to get. As to today, we need look only at the morning's newspaper to realize that Africa is aflame, that new and untried governments are emerging in that so-called dark continent, that this is an area which must be understood and over as to which we know very little. And we are fortunate indeed in having today a man who does understand and who can tell us about it. Frederick Buechner, for 15 years the manager of Walston and Company in San Jose, has been for 30 years, a writer for newspapers, an observer of world events, a lecturer for the Foreign Policy Association. In World War II, he served as a colonel on the staff of General Bradley and General Collins. He wears the two bronze star. He spoke to this club some time ago in 1954 after visiting the troubled spots on the Red China border in Himalaya, and now he has just returned after 4 months in Africa, having visited such places as Leopoldville, the Congo, South Africa, Mozambique, Central Africa, Madagascar, Tanganyika, Kenya, and Nairobi. Even the name sounds strange, and so we certainly need the information and need the knowledge and need the understanding which will be brought to us today by our speaker. Is there a nascent nationalism in Africa, or indeed is there the myth of African nationalism? And I'm happy to introduce to you Mr. Frederick Buechner. Mr. Buechner.
Thank you, Judge. President Lloyd, fellow members of the Commonwealth Club, and guests. Need I say that it's a great honor to be invited back for the second time to address this club, which I assure you is well known all over the world. I have laid on your tables a little reprint, an article I saw in the New York Times coming through on Saturday. I asked the latex company to reprint them for me, and I brought them. They will give a light on the theme of what I'm talking about, but I would ask that you put them in your pocket and read them after the meeting and not during the next 27 minutes. I suppose I could be the most popular speaker in California if I were to say, Jambo! Ooh-hoo! Because this is the signal given to from African to African, particularly in East Africa, as they cry for freedom. But I want to tell you a little story, a story that was told to me by a black man in the jungles of western Tanganyika. I was asking him what he thought of this new freedom they were seeking, the independence, and the place that America and the colonial power had. He said, when God made this earth, He put an African, an Indian, and a European. He meant a black man, brown man, and a white man. At the bottom of a pit. And when they wakened and looked up, they saw the sky and the sun far above them. And they all wondered how they could get out. The white man tried to climb up, and he fell back many times. And finally, with his bare hands, he scratched steps in the side of that pit. And after many efforts, succeeded in climbing to the top. The Indian watched him. And then, following in his steps, he too climbed to the top. The African looked up, looked at the distance, turned over, went back to sleep. And as this old fellow said, we're still sleeping, and we don't want to be wakened. I'm sure versions of that story you've heard before. But coming from an African in the bush who spoke only his own dialect and a little Swahili, I was intrigued by the way he felt. Now, I have no desire today to harangue or engage in histrionics. I could, of course, say that the jungle drums are beating and the symphony of freedom is ringing in Africa. Actually, it's not a symphony anyway. It's a cacophony. I prefer not to engage in the oratory. I want to give you a report, and I think that's the way you'd prefer. For the purpose of time, I must omit Madagascar and Mozambique. If you like to bring that up in the question period, that would be fine. And this talk is limited, as you know from your bulletin, to South, East, and Central Africa. I have not been in North Africa on this trip, and I have spent limited time in Western Africa. We've been asked as a nation to espouse the cause of African nationalism. What is it? What does it entail? What does it mean to us? What does it embrace? I spent 4 months in this area talking to people 14 hours a day in an attempt to get some light on what it means to them and what it means to us. What I discovered, I feel, is shocking. You've got to be there to believe it. You've got to see it. You've got to hear it. You've got to smell it. It was only yesterday that the United States emerged from their policy of isolationism to embrace internationalism. And concurrently with that, strangely enough, we advocated and supported what amounts to almost chauvinism in these newly emerging countries throughout the world. I think this apparent incongruity also needs some examination. Webster says nationalism is devotion to one's country, putting national interests before international interests, or a desire for international independence. What does it mean to Africans? And what does African nationalism mean to us in the United States? There are 5 categories that I feel should be explored. First, is it love of country? Is it devotion to country? Or is it love of tribe? Or is it perhaps a desire to return to tribal customs? Regression. Or is it Pan-Africanism? Africa for the Africans, all blacks, get rid of the whites. Or is it purely a struggle for personal political power? Now, whether it engages any of these 5 categories, it will include and must include the personal policies of some of the leaders, Albert Luthuli, Dr. Hastings Banda, Tom Mboya, Ogingo Odinga, Lumumba, Kasavubu, Tsiranan, and the rest of them whose names you've been hearing and reading about in the paper. Let's explore first love of country. What country? Are we talking about Kenya? South Africa? Tanganyika? Who drew the boundaries of these so-called countries? It wasn't the indigents. It wasn't the African. It was the European, wasn't it? The European drew lines which defined what country shall be Tanganyika, in that case Germany, Kenya, in that case England, Congo, in that case Belgium, and so forth. And many times those lines ran right through a tribal area. For instance, the Maasai. They're cut by Tanganyika-Kenya border. They're on both sides. The Somali are in both Kenya and Somalia. The Bakongo, Congo, Angola, French Congo, the Makonde, Nyasaland, and Mozambique. The Turkana are divided 3 ways, Uganda, Kenya, and the Sudan. If they feel their nation is tribal, then their nation has been cut by an arbitrary boundary which has been drawn by a foreign power. On the other hand, we have some nations, tribal nations, which are totally within the European areas. Take the Zulus, the Swazis, the Basutus, the Wakambas, they're entirely within what we know as a colony. So, thinking of a nation as we do, boundaries, one type of person, one ethnic group, it is not devotion to a country. Is it devotion to a tribe? Each tribe considers itself a nation in Africa. I talked with Gacha Buthelezi, the chief of the Mashlabatini tribe in Zulu. He said, we are a nation, and we want to be free. We want to establish our own boundaries, our own nation, and secede from South Africa. Strangely enough, he said, if we cannot do that, we would rather be a colony of Great Britain. In East Africa alone, you have 200 tribes. And each tribe, believe me, hates the other one. In Kenya, you have 44 alone. These tribes would destroy the present borders. And you presently have agitation among the Somali, for instance, to join Somalia in the northern part and eastern part of Kenya. If they return to tribes, then this will result in tribal warfare, resulting from jealousies, a reversion to the customs, which they still practice in many places. And this, in turn, would present a colossal problem to the United Nations, because these tribes are not viable, neither are many of the countries that are presently being formed, that are being independent. They're already a problem to the United States and the United Nations, because when you take small areas like Madagascar with 5 million people, Kenya with 6, or a small so-called country like Mauritania with only 600,000, less than the population of San Francisco, call themselves a nation, want admittance to the United Nations, and with all the diplomatic connections that it involves. Madagascar has 6 million people, about half the population of New York City. Thirdly, a desire to return to tribal customs. This definitely enters the picture. There is a move in Africa to rid themselves of the white man's customs. They want to rid themselves of Christianity. And this was shown during the Mau Mau uprising, when many of Christian customs were aborted to their own way of tribal customs, singing Christian hymns and using words as parodies, which were actually revolutionary. They want to return to what I would term no pressures. Civilization and white men have brought with them pressures for the African. In the old days, there was no population explosion, for instance. 80% of their infants died before they reached the age of 1 year. Their cattle were wiped out through drought, disease, and war, and they didn't have the problem of overgrazing. Now we've helped them save their children, we've helped them save their cattle, and then we turn around and tell them about birth control, and we tell them that not to raise as many cattle because we don't have the ground for them to graze on. And the black man looks at us and wants to know which we really advise. They don't want to work. Or the 1% you hear about, the 1% you listen to, the 1% that you talk to, perhaps. But by and large, the African wants only subsistence. He's satisfied to lay around, grow enough on the ground, and as one man said to me when he evidenced some interest in our foreign aid program, he said, yes, he said, I'm an old man. I've worked hard all my life. I think somebody should help me now. I said, what do you do that's so hard? What hard work do you do? He said, in the morning I send the children out to guard the cattle, and a little later I send my wives out, he had 8 of them, to work in the fields. But what do you do? Well, I've got to go down and talk to the elders under the tree in the village and discuss the problems. Tribal customs, you can read them in any book, but I think we can take a minute and review some of them. The African buys his wives with cows. He can have 2, 4, 6, 8. I met one that had 12. Polygamy, he may have 12 wives, his friend may have none. So his friend can borrow some of his wives once in a while, particularly if he's a blood brother, which means if they were circumcised at the same time. The women are the workhorses. That's why they have 8 or 10 wives. Put them out to work in the field. As a matter of fact, the first, second, and third wife is very much interested in him marrying the fourth time, because that will be a little more help around the house and out in the fields. They do not want registration of land. Most of it is tribal owned. They look with suspicion upon any plan of registering their land and getting a title in fee simple to it. They would prefer to have an area belonging to the tribe. Their ethical standards, of course, are far from ours. We can't use our yardsticks in Africa at all. For instance, stealing. Well, we consider that a crime, particularly when you get caught. With them, stealing is no crime. If you steal something you need and you don't get caught, fine. If you do get caught, and it's a white man's law, then the great white father puts you in a house much nicer than you have, and he feeds you for free. And if it's tribal law, you run a spear through the man that caught you, or through the man that stole your cattle. These are standards that we can't understand here. And that's why I say that it is necessary to see it and live with it. I spent a month in the West Tanganyika jungle and 10 days with very, very primitive tribes in the south of Madagascar. Some of their customs are almost unbelievable. Radio prohibits me from describing some of them to you. In the question period, perhaps we can discuss them. The tribes have few restrictions. They want to revert to that because they feel then they'd be freer and lazier. Fourthly, Pan-Africanism. There's a hate campaign on in Africa against whites. Africa for the Africans. It's a rallying point, and the demagogues are using it to whip their people into emotional frenzies. We think sometimes Africa should be for the Africans. Well, if that's the point, then let's make England for the English and America for the Americans and send the Africans back to Africa. And that would really create a problem for them, wouldn't it? Or even more so, let's say America for the Indians. They had it first. If that sounds silly, then make a parallel with your African problem. Struggle for personal power. I think perhaps this is the crux of the matter. I think it's the biggest factor. With few exceptions, perhaps with a man like Nyerere, they're all jockeying in order to gain personal power and exploit their own people. They're not interested in, for the most part, they're not interested in education or economic stability. Otherwise, they'd tread more lightly, they'd go more slowly. If this is not so, why have they told their people or allowed them to believe that freedom comes in a box, as many of them thought? Where is my freedom? Nobody has handed it to me. Or that once freedom comes in independence, the dirt in the backyard will turn to gold. Or they'll all be rich. They'll all own land. Or they'll have the white man's house, wife, and car. They've allowed them to believe this. In many cases, they've promised it to them. They've invented slogans to enslave their own people. The leaders of those parties, in my opinion, may well become the next colonialists in Africa. Because we mustn't forget, it was the chiefs of the tribes who in the old days sold their own people into slavery. I heard a cute little story that goes around in Kenya, that Tom Mboya, as he goes throughout Kenya and meets his groups, which are always well prepared before he gets there, and he shouts, "Uhu, Uhuru," and they shout back, "Uhuru." He was taking a train from Kenya to Mombasa, and at each station he met mobs of Africans. And in one there was an Arab, and he stood right up front, and he looked at Mboya and he said, "Uhuru." And Mboya said, "I'm quite surprised. Why do you call freedom an Arab?" "Oh," he said, "once you get rid of the British, we can start buying and selling you fellows again." Whether African nationalism means any of those five categories, it's got to be based on some of the policies or some of the things that have happened under some of the leaders. Let's look at a few of them. Albert Luthuli in South Africa. He was head of the African National Congress, which was banned after the emergency took place, and he was put into detention. You've read of some of the uprisings and some of the outbreaks in South Africa. But did you know that last April in Cato Manor, which is near Durban, when the police went to raid an illicit still of 11 police, 9 were killed. The killing wasn't the important thing. After they were dead, the Africans moved in and beat their bodies to a pulp, a bloody mess, bashing in their heads and cutting up their bodies afterward. In Port Elizabeth, 2 years ago, otherwise peaceful natives who had been working in the homes and in the factories turned after a fiery speech by one of their leaders, burnt the child's clinic, overturned and burned cars, one of which contained a nun. She was roasted, and they ate her. In Sharpeville, when it took place last spring, you read about it, you were shocked because of the natives, the Africans that were killed. But the Africans actually put their women and children in the front lines. This they had never done before. Always the warriors precede the mob. This time they put their children first, their women next. And it was felt that it was a very, very well-directed plot. Dr. Hastings Banda, Nyasaland. He's a screaming, hysterical firebrand that cries, independence and chaos. I would rather have that than remain in the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland. He prefers that, and his is a reign of intimidation. If you don't belong to the Malawi Party Congress, then your wife will be intimidated, your children will be stopped in school, the worker himself will be told what dire things will happen to his family if he doesn't join Malawi, support them, and work for them. I talked to his secretary treasurer, Henry Chippenberry, a few days after he was released from prison. This is a paragraph out of a tape-recorded interview. The mass of the people don't know what it's all about. They know little or nothing of the United States. What we leaders think today, the masses will think tomorrow. We are not viable, I know that. But we'll get our deficit from the United States. And if they refuse, we go to Russia. And this is the bogey that is continually raising its head in Africa, as it is in other parts of the world, playing the United States against Russia. Kwame Nkrumah. He's called the showboy in Africa. And we call Ghana the showplace, the black showplace. But I think in the last few weeks you've read that he's practically in the red camp. It looks more like a red camp. Nkrumah and his party beat, flog, and imprison without trial the opposition. There's censorship of the press, curtailment of many publications. He's an ambitious colonialist who would like to head all Africa. He's already stated his claims to Togo and a piece of the Ivory Coast. And as you know, as you read, he has injected himself in the Congo situation with much emphasis. And we have Kenneth Kaunda in northern Rhodesia, who just got out of jail, Joshua Nkomo, who just came back from exile in England, and of course Sekou Touré of Guinea. This is practically a communist province. Everything in the place is Russian. Russian food, Russian language, Russian newspapers, cigarettes. And I'd like to tell you a little story about what happened just before I got there. We had given Guinea 5,000 tons of rice. At almost the same time, Communist China gave her 5,000 tons of rice. Communist China's rice was accompanied by one of its diplomats. A little later, the 10,000 tons of rice was thrown on the open market by Touré, and in spite of the fact that it had been a gift, it was thrown on the open market and drove the price from 80 cents down to below 40 cents. And the reaction of the people was, this is wonderful, since our agreement with Communist China, we've been able to cut the price of rice in half. I don't have to talk about Lumumba. You've read enough about him. While I was there, he called all journalists liars. He suppressed the press, put some journalists in prison. And when we asked why he called us liars, he said, you put out a story that a white woman had been raped 20 times before she was disemboweled. He said, that's a lie. She was only raped 5 times. This is the viewpoint some of those people have. Dr. Mungai Njoroge, a fine man supported today by Medico, Tom Dooley's outfit, graduated Stanford University, is doing a great work with his own people. But even he advocates the release of Jomo Kenyatta. Jomo Kenyatta went to jail, as you probably know, for 7 years for his part in organizing Mau Mau. In southern Rhodesia, I talked to the only African who has attained the rank of junior minister, Jasper Savanu. He's joint secretary of the Ministry of Home Affairs for Race Relations. And this is off a tape recorded interview. The white liberals who have championed our cause will be the first to be liquidated when we come into power. People like South Africa's Leo Cooper and Alan Paton. They have delayed our independence by trying to change the European. We would have had independence sooner if they hadn't tried to reconcile us. We have no patience with these people. And he contradicted himself many times as he yawned in my face during the half-hour interview. This is the type of thinking of an African who has attained the rank of junior minister. KANU, Kenya African National Union, the strongest party in Kenya, is fighting among themselves. There are three distinct factions, and they're at each other's throats. Here are the three men and how they think. James Gichuru, the president. While I was there, he made this statement in a public speech. When we take over, we will make the Europeans kneel to us. They are the immigrants. The rulers will become the ruled. Now, perhaps we, as Americans, sophisticated in politics, would cast this aside and say, well, it's just an election speech. He doesn't mean it. When they get independence, it won't mean anything. But the Africans do believe it, and they expect these things, and they've done it, and that's what happened in the Congo. They were told they could have the boss's wife and his car and his home, and they believed it, and they put it into effect. Oginga Odinga, the vice president of KANU, has spent much time behind both the bamboo and iron curtain, gets his financial support presently from Peking and brags about it. He also brags that he was Jomo Kenyatta's right-hand man, and he said, if not the right-hand man, then the left, during Mau Mau. He's an emotionalist, an extremist, a racist. He agrees with Mau Mau, but he doesn't agree with James Gichuru. And then the third, Tom Mboya, whose name you probably know the best, who's Secretary General of KANU and head of the Kenya Federation of Labor. He's loved and lionized outside Kenya and hated and feared within it, with the exception of his own little group in Nairobi. He rules by intimidation. He's been a student of Hitler. He sends out a goon squad when people don't agree with him. It may be just coincident that some of his critics wind up in the back alley, beaten up. He always sends a big group ahead when he's going to address an audience to assure them a hilarious welcome and have plenty of friends among the audience. But his hecklers don't fare so well. An American Negro editor from the Washington area 6 months ago visited Kenya, talked with Tom Mboya, and when he finished, said, "This man, when scratched, shows he is a savage." He said that Mboya talked like the Ku Klux Klan in the United States. He gets some of his money, so I'm told, from the AFL-CIO in the United States, other money from an American foundation, which has given him considerable sums for education. The students who are going to use these sums are not screened. These scholarships are given out as political plums. The union contracts he holds all over Kenya are fantastic. They call for a 10% annual increase in pay. After 1 year's service, a month's vacation with pay, plus expenses. After 3 years' service, 3 months with pay. At the end of each year, a 60% bonus. And pregnant women get 2 months before the birth and 3 months after, all with pay. He has a stranglehold on labor in Kenya Colony. And then we come to Jomo Kenyatta, the myth, or he's being built into a myth. All over East Africa, they're calling for his release. They're asking that he be prime minister of Kenya. They're asking that he be prime minister of a giant federation in Central Africa, including Mozambique, Angola, and the Congo. Whether he'll be released or not is a question. Everybody would like the answer. I talked with the governor general, and I can't give you the answer today because the release will be in the Oakland Tribune on Monday as to whether he'll be released and, if so, when. Gentlemen, contrasted with Asians and Europeans, the African has never produced anything on his own, nothing in letters, art, science, industry. He is actually an anachronism in today's atomic world. He lives in the year 3000 B.C. to 1000 A.D. Now, it's true, we went through that period and we got here where we are. How can we expect him to jump it in one generation, even with our help, which many times he doesn't want? He thinks differently, he acts differently, he reacts differently. Remember that bending the branch of a tree and letting it go accomplishes nothing. If we bend the branch of a tree and hold it, we may be able to then leave an impression on that branch. There is no such thing as African nationalism, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Buechner, for that most informative talk. Now the question period will be conducted by the president of the club, Mr. Lloyd Graybill. Mr. Graybill.
Thank you, Justice Matt Tobrainer, for being here today again. It's always nice to have you aboard. Now, Colonel Buechner, we have two or three questions that seem to explore how you got around and did all this. How did you talk with the people who are divided into so many tribes, presumably with different languages? How did you talk to them?
I carried interpreters.
That's a good answer.
Various interpreters for various areas.
Apropos of your discussion of the various five factors involved in the myth of African nationalism, has not African nationalism one thing in common? Namely, the hatred of foreign domination.
I think perhaps we covered a little of that, in that there isn't any African nationalism. The hatred is being whipped by the people at the top. It is not a grassroots movement. There is hatred at the top, but certainly I would say at least 75% and probably as much as 90% of the people you talk to in the rural areas, in the bush, in the backwoods, have no hatred for foreigners.
We have a question here now we should take care of from our safari past president of the Commonwealth Club, Dave Bohannon. What is the future of hunting safaris in Africa?
Well, I did a three-week safari. They're rather gloomy. The safari people, like Karen Downey and Safaris Unlimited and so forth, would have us believe that everything's fine as far as the safari business is concerned. Now, as far as tourism in Kenya is concerned, you have no fear that tourism has dropped off drastically. They're very much worried about it because ships are being routed away from Mombasa. However, there is widespread poaching. And the poaching is taking place either with old 100-year-old blunderbusses, with poison arrows, with traps, and snares and other things of that type. And the game, I think, is being depleted quite rapidly. The consensus of opinion seems to feel if you want to hunt in Africa, you better get there within the next 3 or 4 years.
Goodbye, Dave. Dave will be on his way again. Now, Colonel Buechner, I know you had to leave a little bit for this period. Comments on the current political situation in Mozambique and Madagascar. Now, along the line, would you, in connection with your comments on Kenya, talk a little bit more about the Mau Mau atrocities that we hear and read so much about, in addition to what you've said?
It might be well to point out some of the oaths that they're required to take. It also may be that if this is being recorded for radio, it will have to be censored before being released. These are some of the things that the members of the Kikuyu and other tribes who come under Mau Mau are required to swear to. When called upon to do so, I will help dispose of the body of a murdered person so it won't be found. When I am called upon to do so with four others, I will kill a European. If called upon to do so, I will kill a Kikuyu who is against Mau Mau, even though it be my mother or father, sister or brother, wife or child. I will denounce the Christian faith. I will steal firearms. I will chase the Europeans from Kenya. Now, this is the oath. The oathing ceremonies are so debased that most of it is not in print. The ceremonies consist mostly of sex, acts, and customs. Now, the idea is to so debase the participant that he cannot associate in any other company or society. He must stick to those who have gone through these oathing ceremonies, because they themselves feel debased, and they become a club. Now, after these ceremonies have taken place, then the atrocities take place. You've read of some of them. They've cut live children into strips and eaten their flesh. They've disemboweled live pregnant women and eaten their intestines. They've amputated the hands and feet of children and left them to die. They've done this also with cattle as an example, an intimidation for those who refuse to join Mau Mau. They've punctured and mutilated cattle. They've barricaded non-supporters in their homes and then set fire to the homes. In the outbreak in 1952, 3, and 4, there were only 52 whites killed. The general feeling among us, I think, has been that this was a movement against whites. There were only 52 whites, but there were thousands of their own who were killed and mutilated at that time. Now, this question asks, what is the current political situation in Mozambique and Madagascar? I couldn't possibly cover both unless I take the rest of the allotted time. Madagascar became an independent country the 1st of August and elected to stay within the French community. It was a French colony before that. It's an offbeat place. Very few people go there. The occasion of an American journalist, even a part-time one like myself, was a great occasion. They trotted out the president and all the other people for me, and I had interviews all the way down, and then they gave me a car and a chauffeur and an interpreter, and I spent 10 days down in the southern part of Madagascar, where we find atavism and animism, their custom, and people very, very seldom see a white man. The Malgash language is common to all the island, which is a distinction from Africa, where we have so many different dialects. Whether the West Coast native, who is descended from the African, the East Coast native, who is descended from the Arabs, or the Plateau Malgash, who is mostly Malayan, Javanese, no matter which group he falls in, he speaks Malgash. So they have a common language. Now, the political situation is one that's tenuous at the moment because we find a lot of anti-French feeling among the illiterate people. This is almost in contrast to Africa. Many of the small-town and small-time politicians, the chef de district, chef de poste, like our mayors and our county managers, wish that the French would leave now. And many of them said, I wish the bad French would go now and the good French would go soon. And asked what he meant by good French and bad French. Well, the bad French were those who criticized the Malgash, and the good French were those who were pouring money into the place, but soon we won't need them either because we'll have the United States. Madagascar is a huge island. It's 1,100 miles long, which would reach from about Atlanta, Georgia, to Montreal, Canada. It takes a lot of time to cover. It is not in the category of being in Africa. As President Suriname said, we are a crossbreed nation. We are at the crossroads of Africa and Asia. We have some of each customs, but we don't want to be identified with either. Their economic situation is precarious. The banks have outstanding loans, which they are very much worried about, and if they foreclose on the loans, they will throw a lot of people into bankruptcy. There have been 2,000 Frenchmen leave the island since freedom was obtained, the 1st of August, that have left by air. They've left by sea. The number that have left by air has not been determined. But there has been something of a flight, and that has slowed up at the present time. Obviously, the French must stay because illiteracy is very high, probably 90 or 95% overall the island, although Tananarive, the capital, has probably one-third of their people that are literate. In the south, some of the customs are just unbelievable, but the situation seems to be under control of President Suriname, who comes from the Mayunga area, which is the northwest, and is actually descended from African. There is rivalry between the coastal people and the plateau people. The coastal people are usually darker in color because they're African or Arab, and the people on the plateau are lighter, having come from the area of Malaya. They vie for power, but at the present time, the coastal tribes have about a 5-3 numerical majority over the plateau tribes. The plateau tribes were the ones that used to rule this area before they became a colony. In Mozambique, this is a colony you don't hear much about. It's very difficult to get any information. I spent 3 weeks there, of which about 2.5 weeks were spent futilely. I could look at the place superficially. I found happy people, very gracious, courteous Portuguese, ostensibly happy natives. The Portuguese might have something. They don't have any underground. They don't have any African movement. They have what they term an assimilado program, whereby if a native complies with certain requirements, studies and becomes literate, becomes a Christian, and knows how to use a knife and fork instead of eating raw people, they will allow him then to join their society. Now, I use society in quotes, of course, because there is no color bar in Mozambique. There is a culture bar. And if he's able to move up in the ladder of culture, then he will become a member of them. Actually, he is a Portuguese citizen anyway, and I imagine that the number that they have is about between 30 and 40,000 that have become assimilados, have been taken into the Portuguese family. They have about 6 million who have not been taken in. But it is something that they aim for. It's a goal. It's a prize held out to them. So that if you accomplish these things, then you make your application to the native board, and they take it under consideration. But they have no African National Congress. They have no Pan-Africanist movement. They have no Malawi party or any of these other parties that we find throughout East Africa. They do not tolerate any of these parties. But I said I spent 2.5 weeks before I could find out what was going on underneath. I did find that there is unrest among the Portuguese themselves. They would like more autonomy for Mozambique. They would like to do things without having to go back to Lisbon. They can't build a school without having the plans approved in Lisbon. The church situation, I won't discuss, but it leaves a lot to be desired. Dr. Salazar is actually a captive of some of the priests, and they're running Mozambique just the way they want to. And included in it is much morality, immorality. The children are not being taught, the native children are not being taught as they're supposed to be taught. The money is donated for the schools, but instead it goes into great big edifices, mostly churches built in the middle of the jungle, where a lot of people are wearing not only their own fetishes, but a cross as well. Mozambique is an enigma at the moment, and perhaps something will come out of this movement by some of the government people to allow Mozambique to become more autonomous and run more of her own affairs.
Now, Colonel Bickner, two or three questions on the current Congo situation, which we have about a minute and a half to radio time left. First, why did Belgium, after all these years, suddenly relinquish the Congo so quickly? And what, in your opinion, are the chances that United Nations efforts in the Congo will be successful?
I wish I could find a statement that I have here from a businessman. This is John Hughes, the Ford dealer in Nairobi, and he typifies the statements of businessmen made in East Africa to me. We're sick and tired of U.S. meddling in British colonial affairs and of that old girl Eleanor and a coterie of do-gooders. This whole trouble in Africa started with the Suez when the United States sided with Russia against France and England. That was the cue, the signal the Africans were waiting for. America thinks all Africans are educated and civilized. Surely you've been here long enough to realize differently. Stick to your Indian problems. Surely America has nothing to brag about in that respect. Now, he went on to say, I don't have the quote here, he went on to say that, and the governor of Kenya agreed, that the Congo situation was aided and abetted by the United States. We made it go too fast. We brought pressure to bear on Belgium to get out. And they blame, to sum it up, they blame almost everything that's wrong in that part of Africa on us. The chances of the United Nations efforts in the Congo to be successful, at the present, the outlook is very poor. They feel that if they're going to be successful, they'll have to throw a lot more troops and a lot more money, and it'll take 5 years at least.
Colonel Bickner, we thank you for a vivid and amazing expression.
This is Stuart Richardson Ward, and across from the microphone sits me Frederick Beekner, San Jose resident manager of Walston Company, who's just returned from a 4-month field study of Africa. Mr. Beekner spoke before the weekly general meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California here at the Sheraton Palace Hotel in San Francisco, and his topic was the myth of Africa's nationalism. Mr. Beekner, you opened by noting that we in the United States have been asked to espouse the cause of African nationalism, and maybe we ought to know what we're talking about in making our decisions, that we only recently got away from keeping out of international affairs to being now where we are advocating freedom for all sorts of previously non-independent countries. And you asked the question, rhetorical question, is it Pan-Africanism, or is it a struggle for personal political power in Africa on the part of a few educated Africans who want to exploit their people? What is going on in Africa today? And you suggested that the boundaries of these countries are an important factor. And you know, Fred, I haven't heard anybody speak about the picture of those boundaries. Will you tell our audience what you found there?
Well, it's surprising to hear that people don't speak about it here. It seems quite a common thing in Africa. When we espouse the cause of what we call African nationalism, we should know what it is. Webster says that nationalism is a love or devotion to country. So the first consideration, in my opinion, is what country is becoming independent? Is it a country? What constitutes these new countries that Africa has?
Now, you said, Mr. Beekner, that there were 200 tribes in East Africa, that Kenya alone had 44, and so on. What does that mean in your interpretation, sir?
Well, each tribe considers itself a nation. They refer to themselves as a nation. And when these colonies were formed, they were formed by European nations, be they British, Belgian, French. And it's the European countries who drew the lines and made them a country. Obviously, the African doesn't think of those lines when he refers to nationalism. The Maasai want their own nation. The Kikuyu want their own nation. The Zulus want their own nation. And their borders in no way coincide with the borders established for any of the countries.
And if we should get out, we of the free West, and if the communists should not get the control there, what would become of these Africans? What would be their condition after we get out?
I feel that the Africans would regress. They'd return to tribalism, jealousies, tribal warfare, witch doctors, decimation through drought, disease, and warfare. Of course, this is a sort of a passive existence that they enjoyed before, and they, in many cases, resent the white man's pressure.
They don't like our moral and ethical standards, did you say?
Well, of course, no, of course not. They have polygamy. They have all the way up to 12 wives in some cases, and if their brother doesn't have a wife, they'd just as soon loan him one or two.
You said that he gets into trouble from stealing, which he considers a legitimate
well,
way of doing business.
Stealing is not a crime there. Stealing is a crime to us, especially if we're caught, you know.
But he gets free board in jail if he's caught there.
Well, if he's caught there, he goes to jail and he lives in a nicer house than what he has, and he gets free food, and that's not too bad from his viewpoint.
Fred, admittedly, I'm rushing you in these little 15 minutes because you've got so much material here. It's good for 2 hours. And I wanted you to talk, if you would, a minute about how about this Africa for the Africans that we Americans think we know about and it sounds good to us.
Well, an African, after all, is not a nationalist. An African is only the color of the skin. We refer to African as synonymously as we would a Negro. And if we want Africa for the Africans, then we might just as well have England for the English and America for the Americans. And if that were to happen, England and America would have to send all the Africans back to Africa, and then they really would have a problem.
But have these whites recently come to Africa?
Well, these whites have been there in South Africa for 300 years. It's their home. And if they leave Africa, they have no place to go.
Well, that's longer than we've been here in the Palace Hotel in San Francisco.
As a matter of fact, South Africa was colonized 2 years after the $24 was paid for Manhattan.
Well, now, how about who would be the next colonialists, as you call them, if the white people go out?
Well, it's my opinion, and colonialism will return to Africa. I don't know whether it's the old style that has been in existence, or whether it'll be the Soviet style, or whether it'll be perhaps an African style. But in my opinion, the latter would be the more probable, where an African will exploit his own people.
Fred, you painted a terrific picture today of what the emotionalism is down there. What does that amount to? The rabble-rousers, you call them.
I feel that you have a few savages who have the veneer of a college education scratched, and they reveal what they really are. There are a few exceptions to this, of course. The moderates in Africa, but I'm afraid some of them are marked for assassination, to quote the people around them. And the emotionalists, like Dr. Hastings Banda, He's a firebrand. He rules by intimidation. The rabble rouses, rise them to emotional frenzy. They don't know what they're doing. They scream and chant and have battle cries. And they first destroy the things which have done the most for them, like their child clinics and their hospitals and their stores and their libraries.
They destroy those things?
That's the first thing. And
they
then in Cato Manor, they burn them all down. And then, of course, clubbed to death 9 of the policemen.
All right. Well, now let's go on to what you said to the Commonwealth Club about the efforts to get economic aid from various nations.
Well, they play one against the other. They continually raise this bogey of Russia, you see.
United States versus England.
Versus Russia. They tell us that if they're not viable and they have a deficit, as they do in Nyasaland, of £3.5 million or $10 million a year.
Fred, that's a good word that you as a stock and bond man know, but viable, I believe, means if their conditions are not so that they can support themselves. Is that what you mean by viable?
Well, yes, viable would mean that they could support themselves and they can live on their own. At the present time, Nyasaland is being given $10 million a year by Rhodesia. When I asked Henry Chippenberry, the treasurer of the Malawi Party Congress in Nyasaland, how he would get along, because they're getting $10 million a year, he said, oh, we'll get it from the United States. And then he looked at me and sort of smiled wryly and said, and if you won't give it to us, we'll get it from Russia.
Well, that's about par for the course in a lot of countries today. And you went on, Frederick Buechner, to say that in your 4 months there that you had talked with a number of people and that there is sort of a, what we would call in this country, egghead type of leadership sometimes. And what did you say would happen to these, white liberals or white eggheads in Africa if complete independence comes?
This is almost a paradox, but some of the black leaders, the African leaders, feel that the liberals in Africa, the white liberals who have championed their cause, should be the first to be liquidated when they get independence. And asked to explain that, they feel that the white liberals have stepped into the breach in the, between the black and the white and attempted to ameliorate the situation, and it has staved off the time of their independence. So they blame them for the postponement of independence in some cases and say they're going to be liquidated.
Did you find any evidence of activity either by Moscow or by the Chinese communists from Peking?
Oh, it's all over Central Africa.
It is?
It's all over.
How'd you know, Fred? You were there 4 months, but you had interpreters.
It's common talk that Guinea and Ghana are in the camp. Ethiopia is swarming with Russians. And Madagascar is terrified of Russian infiltration. Uganda is being attacked by Red China, I mean with propaganda and visitors from Red China. And Peking has given a lot of money to Oginga Odinga, who's the vice president of the Kenya African National Union.
You spoke about Lumumba, whom we hear about in the newspapers a lot.
Well, probably here in the United States you've read more about Lumumba than what I ran into. But Lumumba, while I was there, was hit over the head one night when he tried to stop a riot. He said he wasn't hurt. Of course, we can believe this. He immediately threw some of the journalists in jail, suspended publications, and then called all journalists a liar.
Now, how about this man, Gachuro? What did he say?
James Gachuro?
You talked to him.
James Gachuro is the president of the Kenya African National Union, and he is the figurehead, at least. He's coming into more power because Tom Mboya has had to give up some of his. Gachuro made a speech while I was in Kenya in which he said that when they come into power and gain their independence, the Europeans will have to kneel to the Africans. He said they will then be the subjects and the immigrants, and the rulers will become the ruled.
Well, how about the results of our United States policy in Africa as summarized by these people you talked to, Colonel Buechner?
They feel that we have prematurely supported some of these leaders. For instance, Tom Mboya has been pretty well accepted in the United States. He's lionized. He's loved here. Actually, he's hated and feared in Kenya for the most part because he rules by intimidation. But in the United States, we support Tom Mboya. Now, in the supporting of Tom Mboya, we have thrown Oginga Odinga, who is the vice president of KANU, into the arms of the Russians because he is jealous of Mboya's popularity here. So he seeks his own popularity in another country.
Well, what was the type of methods that Mboya uses in order to get this power? Because he surely has had a lot of power.
It is common belief and acceptance there that he uses a goon squad.
How about the real popularity, personal popularity within his own area?
He is feared in Kenya.
And you quoted a United States Negro editor.
Yes. I am sorry I can't reveal his name. It was given to me in confidence. But a United States Negro editor from the Washington area visited Kenya 6 months ago. He talked to Mboya, and when he was finished, he made the statement that if you scratch Mboya, you find the savage, because as they were both of the same color, Mboya talked frankly, and according to the editor, he spoke like a Ku Klux Klanner.
Well, how about these Negro intellectuals in Africa?
Well, most of them have been trained here, you know.
They have?
Many of them.
And they...
I trained here. I mean, they went to college here and so forth. Most of them have been tainted or infected with communism. Unfortunately, when they come to this country, they are not welcomed. They're not brought into society that you and I think is moderate or middle of the road. And they're welcomed and they're fated by the left-wingers and the communists.
Well, we might say in passing, that's one of the strongholds of commies. That's par for the course in all that are recruiting in this country. Find groups that are neglected and not treated right, and it makes capital for the communists.
Exactly.
What would you say about the feeling of Europeans in Africa? I suppose they're grateful to the United States for our
Europeans
help.
In Africa grateful? Most of them say with they're sick and tired of the United States meddling in their colonial affairs. They feel that they've been there from 60 to 300 years, and certainly they should know how to run the show, and they can do without any interference from the United States. They go on further to say that they can do without any assistance from the United States as far as independence for the African countries are concerned.
Well, Fred, you talked with all sorts of people with the tape recorder in these wonderful 4 months you had there. How about the businessmen doing business in Africa? How do they feel about the United States?
They feel just that way, that the United States has interfered too much. They are going to stay in Kenya. As one man who was 65 years old and a Ford dealer and interested in several other industries said to me, I've been here since I was 10. I intend to stay here. They say they'll make me kneel to them. I'll neither kneel nor will I do anything else. I will stay, and they'll probably kill me, but I'll stay here because this is my home.
Well, we all know that not so long ago up here in Seattle and some other places, there was the IWWs, who were nicknamed the I Won't Workers and called the Wobblies. And their slogan was, Workers of the World Unite. You have nothing to lose but your chain.
Well, unfortunately, that term has been used by representative people from the United States in Africa. They have been so-called leaders. They've been labor leaders, leading journalists, and one from our U.S. State Department, who in effect told the Africans, throw off your chains, you have nothing to lose. I feel they've got everything to lose. And we might add here, what chains?
You referred to some people that you didn't call them exactly that, but pretty nearly prominent and then less than prominent Americans and their attitude there and activities in Africa.
Well, there are several committees here in the United States which call themselves the American Committee on Africa or the American Committee for Africa or the South African Defense Committee. And one businessman in Africa said, we're sick and tired of U.S. interference, and we're sick and tired of that old girl, Eleanor, or a coterie of do-gooders.
How about South Africa? Is the conditions there bad?
South Africa is painted a lot blacker than what it deserves. There's no question about that. While we criticize their segregation policy, we must realize that in South Africa there have been more people with gotten college educations. There have been more professional people trained. We've got more doctors, dentists, lawyers, architects than anywhere else south of the Sahara. I saw one housing development with 100,000 four-room homes, which the African can rent for $4.60 a month.
Thank you very much, Colonel Fred Buechner. And you said towards your close that 90% of the Africans, as you size them up in this 4 months field study, are satisfied, and it's the 10% in the cities that are making the trouble. And then you gave a concluding paragraph. I wish you'd just read that to us, Fred, will you?
Maybe the Russians have a key. They treat them like the children they are. I refer to the Africans. They bring them toys. We treat them as adults, which they're not. They simply are different. They react differently. They think differently. The African is an anachronism in today's atomic world. They are not ready to rule themselves.
Thank you very much, Colonel Fred Buechner. And now may I announce that in the same time, same station next week, I'll be interviewing for you George Rhodes, aviation editor of the San Francisco News Call Bulletin, and his topic will be Hong Kong smuggling of antiques and dope to the United States.